I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome back to Radio Times. It's easy to feel anxious about the fate of the planet and the amount of CO2 emissions that get released into the atmosphere. In 2014, it was 40 gigatons. There are signs everywhere about what this means: sea level rise, droughts, heat waves, intense storms. Our guest Tim Flannery says that while inaction has exacerbated the problem, there are things that can be done to reduce CO2 emissions. He calls it the third way, using the Earth's own self-regulatory system to draw CO2 out of the air through things like seaweed farms and carbon-negative concrete and biochar. Tim Flannery writes about all of this in his new book. It's called Atmosphere of Hope: Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks very much, Marty. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm not used to seeing Atmosphere of Hope, the word hope and climate crisis on the those words on the front of a book.
Well, I couldn't have written that 10 years ago, or 2 years ago even. You know, we've been tracking what the scientists call the worst-case scenario for emissions for the last decade. So, you know, that means that people thought about the future and wondered which way to go, and we're really at the worst end of the range of possibilities. And that 40 gigatons you mentioned that goes into the atmosphere every year, it's a very, very large number. And one way of trying to
understand... I don't even know how to think about that, 40 gigatons.
Well, it's really hard to think about. But one way of trying to think about it is think about how big an area you'd need to replant with forest to take just one-tenth of that out of the atmosphere, you know, because trees absorb CO2 as they grow, right? So it turns out you need to plant an area about the size of Australia, which is almost as big as the contiguous 48 states of the USA. Plant that completely with forest. That'd get you 4 gigatons a year over a 50-year period, you know, on average. So it's a huge, huge number. I tend to just do a shorthand thing and say, you know, that's a volume of significance to the functioning of the planetary system.
As I mentioned, sea level rise, I mean, that is measurable. There's measurable sea level rise. Certainly the eastern coast of the United States has been pretty hard hit by that. You think of ocean acidification, the reefs off of Australia, what are dying. I mean, these are all – there's no hope there. I mean, this is all worrisome, it seems to me.
Well, that's right. You know, what's happened with the huge volume of CO2 we're putting into the atmosphere is that average temperature has risen by just under 1 degree Celsius. I think it's about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit. So, you know, that has broad consequences. There's a lot of melting ice. We know that some of the large glaciers in Antarctica now are committed to melt because mechanically they're unstable, so they're going to flow into the sea and melt, and that'll accelerate sea level rise. The Great Barrier Reef is already half dead. 50% of it's already dead, and the scientists tell us that at 1.5 degrees of warming, the whole thing will be dead. Now, the bad news is that we've already put enough CO2 into the atmosphere that over the next few decades, temperatures will increase to 1.5 degrees, even if we stopped emitting all CO2 today, you know. So there's a lot of grim news out there.
You mentioned a 1 degree increase in global temperature, I think over the last 200 years, something like this, or I guess however far back you can measure it. And I think for the uninitiated, you know, 1 degree, what is that? It doesn't seem that dramatic. And yet it has had such dramatic effects.
It has. And you're quite right that sounds like a very trivial amount, right? But what it's done is increased extreme weather, you know. So it's had a really big impact on extremes. In Australia, things like heat waves are longer, more frequent, and more severe than they've ever been before. You know, last year in Melbourne, we had the tennis open, you know, the Australian Open, which is a great...
I do.
We all go to it in Melbourne. We love it. But last year was a disaster. You know, we had 1,000 spectators treated for heat stress.
Because it was over 100 degrees,
it was well over 100 degrees in the main stadium. Unprecedented conditions due to these heat waves that we've just never had before at that scale. And the players, play had to stop eventually. And you're dealing with a multi-million dollar sporting event there of global significance. And for climate change to stop that is big. Incidentally, the scientists who study these things had a look at what the probabilities were that we'd have a heat wave like the one that stopped the tennis open just through natural causes. Turns out it was less than 1 in 12,000. It's one of those events where we can say this is due to human-caused climate change. It's the extra CO2 in the atmosphere that we've put there that has done this.
What do you say to those people, and they're in your country, they're in our country, they're in probably every country, that say it is not true? Humans are not causing this. There's variation, there's weather, there's, you know, there are bad storms and storms? I don't know.
You've got to say, look, there is variation and there is weather and all of that sort of stuff. That's all true. But, you know, if you want to understand how the climate system works, you need to listen to what the scientists are saying, you know. And we know that the greenhouse gases increase temperatures. We can show that in a laboratory, you know. Everything we know about the way that CO2 increases temperatures is reflected in the changing climate system, in the amount of average temperature increase and then the knock-on consequences of that. But having said that, you know, in Australia, there's probably 5 or 6% of people who will never change their mind, no matter what evidence you put before them. So they're...
What do you do about those people?
We just go around them. There is a huge middle, this huge centre in Australia where people still have open minds on this issue. They want more information. They want to know what the real situation is and what can be done about it. So that's the group that we work at with Australia's Climate Council.
You write, and I scribbled this down, that in Australia... You're the largest CO2 emitter per capita in the world, worse than China, worse than the United States.
It's a very shameful thing to admit, but it is sadly true. And thankfully, there's only 23 million of us, which is small compared with the US or China. But still, it is a terrible situation to be in. Partly, we're in that position because we burn very poor quality coal for our electricity generation, and still about 76% of the electricity mix comes from burning coal. We have an auto sector where it's just closing down now, really, nationally, but we have had an auto sector that produces very inefficient vehicles, and therefore the government's been very reluctant to introduce emission standards for vehicles.
You don't have that?
No, unfortunately, which is a terrible thing for a country our size. And we're also a big country with few people scattered around. So obviously we drive a reasonable amount. So there's a whole lot of factors making us bad. We are working to change that, but I'm very sorry to say we are the biggest per capita emitter in the world as it stands now.
I quoted you in my introduction, 2014, 40 gigatons of CO2 emissions, but you also write that CO2 emissions are not increasing the way that they have been.
Well, this is really some of the cause for hope that when I started to understand, I thought people need to know about this, which is why I wrote the book. It turns out that earlier in the year, the International Energy Agency, who is quite a conservative organisation that's been working for 40 years looking at energy trends, reported that for the first time since they've been keeping records, the global economy grew, but that emissions from the burning of fossil fuels stalled. So they didn't grow in 2014. And that was astonishing news to me because I didn't expect to see anything like that for many, many years to come. But it seems that the very rapid uptake of wind and solar has had an impact, as has the actions of the billions of people around the world who've just tried to be a bit more energy efficient, who've changed their light globes or put solar panels on the roof or maybe helped get a bike lane into the local town or city and maybe walked to work rather than driven their car. All of that stuff has added up to this huge impact. You know, and if you take it at the bigger scale, retrofitting cities is a $2 trillion a year industry.
Huh.
So it's that energy efficiency stuff that's come about that is really one of the big drivers, I think, of this decoupling.
Well, that is good news because oftentimes when we do shows about this, people will write in or call in and say, but what can I do? And you're saying if you change your light bulbs, you might have an impact on how much CO2 we're tossing up into the atmosphere.
I tell you, I was dancing in the street when I got that report. Because,
were you?
Well, I've done all of this stuff for years along with my friends, and you do it a bit half-heartedly thinking, is it going to really make a difference or not? You know, but we now know it's made a really big difference, and it registers in the atmosphere. You know, and that's just fantastic. So everyone who's changed their light globes, who've done the littlest thing for energy efficiency or for dealing with greenhouse gases, you clap yourself on the back because... that is a wonderful achievement that we've had just last year.
You mentioned solar and wind. I was in Germany last year, Eastern Europe last year, and boy, were there a lot, especially in Germany, were there a lot of these gigantic windmills. I mean, you would go over a rise in the road and there was just farms of them. Seemed like almost everywhere.
Yeah, they are. They're very big in Europe and they're very big in Texas as well in this country. And they're growing in Australia. I personally think they look beautiful. They're big white machines and they look fantastic. It turns out that they've been very good for communities and farmers in Australia.
Interesting.
Yeah, because the farmers, you know, in a commodity market, the prices go up and down and a lot of people go bust. But if you've got some wind turbines on your land, it gives you a separate stream of income, which is stable and not linked to the commodity market. So that's good news for them. We've even got to the point in Australia where some communities have built their own wind turbines. There's a place called Hepburn Springs in my state of Victoria where, you know, 1,000 people from a community got together, funded 2 wind turbines, a building of them, and are now shareholders in an electricity generation company, which has been great. Because that money, you know, the way we run it now, the money all goes to the centres. You know, I was talking to a mayor of a little town in Australia, and he said his community bled about $50 million a year in electricity and fuel costs, right? And that money goes to head office down in the capitals or whatever. So he said, if we could just get some local generation here, we'd keep the money in the community, which would be great for us, create local employment, and our young people wouldn't be, you know, going off to town as much. So I think there's a big driver in Australia, at least, to get into this decentralized energy business.
Do you think it's possible to power the earth and everyone with their cell phones and laptops and all using renewables, whether sun or solar, geothermal, all water, I mean, all the other ways that you can do it?
Well, that's the experiment that Germany's running right now. They've committed to getting rid of nuclear and to getting rid of coal and fossil fuels in their energy mix, and they're looking at how you go about generating a stable electricity grid using wind, solar and biomass. I served on the Siemens Sustainability Advisory Board for 10 years and saw this close up, and I can tell you that they're going to achieve that. They will. The transition is going to be a decade-long transition or longer, but the technology is all in place to do that, and it does benefit local communities and people. It enhances your quality of life, it enhances air quality, and it distributes opportunity better than these big centralised systems that we've had up to now.
What's your position on nuclear energy, and have you changed your point of view on that?
Yeah, look, 10 years ago when I wrote my book, The Weathermakers, I thought nuclear had a role in the future. But when you look at what's happened since then, the nuclear industry's contracted quite strongly. It's lost quite a large part of the pie of energy generation. And there's a lot of ageing infrastructure which is not going to be replaced. No one's putting up their hand to build more nuclear plants, really, except China. And the reason it's happening in China is that the government assumes the risk and puts up the capital. It's a centralised system. But in a capitalist system like the US or Australia, that's much less likely to happen. Because you've got to put $15 or $20 billion of capital into a gigantic plant that'll pay back over 50 years, and it's just, wow, it looks risky. Whereas you build wind or solar, you can just build a couple of turbines if you want and do it in a modular way, so you're not risking as much capital. And the costs are coming down so much that they're really cost competitive now.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Tim Flannery. He's a Australian-based scientist, explorer, conservationist. He's also a writer, and he's got a new book called Atmosphere of Hope, subtitled Searching for the Solutions to the Climate Crisis. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. I have some questions about geoengineering, and then we'll be talking about some of his ideas that he calls the third way. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Tim Flannery. He was Australian of the Year in the year 2012. He's the author of a number of books, including Weathermakers, Here on Earth, Among the Islands. And again, he has a new book called Atmosphere of Hope, Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You don't like geoengineering. How come?
I'm frightened by it.
Are you really?
I really am. You know, the temptations to use it are becoming so great. You know, the emissions are being difficult to rein in, so there's a big burden of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. We're seeing that the adverse impacts in many areas are in advance of what the scientists were saying they would be, so heat waves, megafires, rising sea levels. And the temptation of countries to use those solutions is very strong. Mm. There's no global treaty restricting anyone from using them. And what's worse, the research that's been done so far suggests that they're relatively cheap and that they are instantly effective in cooling the planet. But at the same time, they act like a band-aid on a festering wound. Lots of bad things are going on underneath as the greenhouse gases build up. And they'll also, I worry they'll be a trigger for conflict. You know, The Chinese government alone has four major research units looking at geoengineering options right now, and they include things like putting sulfur into the stratosphere to cool the planet. But we know that if they do that, they will have an impact on the South Asian monsoon. And there is 1.4 billion people in South Asia, India and the South Asian nations, who are dependent for their livelihoods on that monsoon. So if you want to trigger for conflict, that looks like a pretty good one to me. But, you know, China in coming decades may be in a position where the temptations to use geoengineering are very great. You can imagine, if you've been to Shanghai, you know how close to the sea it is, how coastal inundation could have a catastrophic impact on that place.
But you're saying it might have a short-term impact. It's not containable, obviously, but it also could have a serious negative long-term impact.
That's right. It would have a short-term impact in terms of cooling the planet. We know that from studying volcanoes and the sulfur they put into the stratosphere. We know we could do it. Anyone can do it fairly cheaply. You just need to add a bit of sulfur to jet fuel and you'd get the impact. Yeah. There's other ways of getting the sulfur up there, but that's one way. So it's very tempting to use this, as I said, because it will cool instantly and slow some impacts. But the rest of the impacts will fester away underneath, including ocean acidification, you know, and that is a major, major threat to our biodiversity. So I see it as it's fighting a poison with a poison. It's dangerous in that way. It's also just a Band-Aid because the sore is just going to keep festering and poisoning the body underneath that Band-Aid. And I, as I said, I really fear that someone will in the next few decades decide geoengineering is the way to go, and it will lead to very bad consequences, including potential conflict between nations.
This book is about something you call the third way. I guess you had to come up with some language to describe, because we're not talking geoengineering here at all. Describe to our listeners what you mean by the third way.
That's right. Well, you know, the first way is to reduce emissions as hard and fast as we can. We all agree we've got to do that. The second way, if that fails, is geoengineering, in my view. But there wasn't a way of dealing with these technologies until I wrote the book that discriminated between geoengineering and other options that really work with Earth's system to strengthen the self-regulation of the Earth system by drawing CO2 out of the atmosphere. And some of those approaches and technologies are really well understood. And we started the program talking about tree planting.
Right.
I mean, that's one way you can draw CO2 out of the atmosphere. But the illustration we used at the beginning of the program shows you how limited that capacity is. You've got to plant all of Australia just to get 4 gigatons out, right? So I started looking around saying, are there other means of doing this? And it turns out there's a whole lot of them, and they fall into two basic categories. In one of them, it's called the biological pathway. You know, the sun powers things. You use green plants and chlorophyll to capture that energy and grab CO2 out of the atmosphere. And there's a lot you can do with that. You know, before we had a fossil fuel industry and a petrochemical industry, there was wood chemists who developed all of the kind of things we need to run a society out of wood, cellulose. Mm. So, you know, you can do that and you can sequester some CO2 as you go doing that. There's a biochar industry in this country and globally that takes biological material, plant waste and so forth, and makes it into charcoal, which is a mineralised form of carbon that doesn't rot as readily in the soil. That's a great approach, but they only produced 1,000 tonnes in 2013, so it's way away from the gigaton scale you need, you know. Some of the most exciting of the proposals in that biological network system are offshore. They're seaweed farms, you know.
Yeah, I found that fascinating.
Yeah, seaweed's so interesting. It grows 30 to 60 times faster than land-based plants, so it captures CO2 really quickly. This desktop study that I talk about in the book suggested if we could plant 9% of the world's oceans with seaweed farms, we'd draw down all of the emissions we're currently putting up in any one year and grow 200 kilograms, or what's that, 400 pounds of protein per head of population for a population of 10 billion.
So we could eat it, right?
Well, that'd be the fish that you'd grow, fish and prawns and things that you'd grow around the seaweed farms, because, you know, seaweed farms are fabulous places for fish and things to live because they take CO2 out of the atmosphere, out of the ocean waters, and they alter the acid balance of the ocean. So they make it less acid, and therefore things that put down skeletons or shells grow really quickly. You know, they're great places for that. But I did a calculation on how big is 9% of the world's oceans.
Good question.
Sadly, it's about 4.5 times the size of Australia. It's a really, really big area. And then the question comes, well, what do you do with all of that seaweed?
Well, exactly.
You
could eat it, I guess.
Well, we'd be eating a hell of a lot of seaweed. It'd be breakfast, lunch and dinner, I think, if we did. But, you know, there are other ways of dealing with it. You can you can use methane digesters, which are very common on farms in this country, to put the seaweed into, generate methane, burn it for electricity, and then sequester the CO2 in shallow sediments under, say, a mile of water depth, you know. If you do that, it's very different to putting CO2 into sediments on land, because the pressure of the water stabilises the CO2 as a liquid and eventually turns to a solid and just stays in the sediments. If you do it on land, of course, the gas is always trying to escape from the rocks up to the surface again. And, you know, ultimately, the excess CO2 that we're put into the atmosphere over geological time, that will all end up at the bottom of the ocean anyway as carbonates and limestones and things like that. So it's, you know, if that proposal really is about shortcutting a natural system and just strengthening Earth's capacity to self-regulate by just hastening that deposition of CO2 into the sediments.
So you're saying, I mean, really think large-scale seaweed farms or some version of that?
Well, we look, I think that's part of the solution. There are a lot of other things as well. But can I just say, when we think about 2050, which is about when these technologies will likely be mature, the only, you know, it's a long time off into the future. Think about living in 1915 and imagining 1950. So here in Philadelphia, it would have been horse-drawn transport, right? Different world. 1950, you've got nuclear weapons, jet aircraft, you know, totally different thing. So we've got to let our imaginations help us to understand the world of the future. And when I talk about these seemingly impossible things like large-scale seaweed farming, let's do it in that context. You know.
Well, I like the idea of large-scale seaweed farming. Not that I would be the farmer, but I find it intriguing. You also talk about carbon-negative concrete. I mean, talk about being kind of concrete here, but what is that?
Concrete is an ancient technology. It goes back to Roman times. And the way we make it now contributes a lot of CO2. It's about 5% of the amount we put up in any one year comes
from
concrete.
Concrete.
Yeah, it does. But there's been a breakthrough recently of people who manufacture what they call carbon negative concrete that actually makes no emissions at all in the process of creating concrete. But then as it sets, the concrete actually absorbs CO2 into its structure over time. So that is a huge breakthrough. The difficulty with adoption of that technology is, even though its manufacturers claim it's lighter, stronger and more durable than Portland cement-based concrete we use now, it hasn't got a track record. So no one's going to make a Brooklyn Bridge or a high-rise out of it at the moment because we don't have that track record. But there are lots of low-risk opportunities for using that concrete that I think we should be engaging with so we can grow that industry to scale. So in 20 or 30 years from now, concrete manufacturing will be part of the solution rather than part of the problem.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. It looks like a lot of people want to join the conversation. That's Tim Flannery, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And he's got a new book. It's called Atmosphere of Hope, Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis. And we've been talking a bit about some of those solutions as he imagines them or sees them, including seaweed farming, reforestation, carbon-negative concrete. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I'm going back and forth between my several screens here. Let me get Neil from Mount Airy to join us. Neil, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I very much appreciate the work of Mr. Flannery. I'd like to offer a critique of this method of optimism. I think one of the big problems is not that we have climate deniers, but it's that our climate or our global warming acknowledgers do not fully comprehend the true threat of global warming. We are possibly facing the end of the world as we know it within 100 years, and to comprehend that is to be very afraid. And I believe that it's that fear that really enables people to make true sacrifices.
You're saying, Neil, that that we could be looking at, what, the end of the world as we know it in 100 years? Is that your view of the future?
Well, we're looking at radical changes to our lifestyle within 100 years, which are going to be so drastic that we can speak them to in that dramatic terms. And I think the tone of optimism is a problem. Obviously, this technology is wonderful and very much appreciated, but it's important to really keep a tone of urgency so that even our global warming acknowledgers, not just that recognize the true threat.
I hear you. No, yeah. Neil, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Tim.
Look, I think, Neil, you're absolutely right that the threat of climate change on the trajectory we're on now is massive. I mean, the Earth is going to be 4 degrees warmer on our current trajectory by the end of the century than it was before the Industrial Revolution, and that will bring about unimaginable change, and that's what we're working to avoid. You know, the Paris meeting is going to change that. We already know from the pledges that are there that we'll be on a trajectory heading towards 2.7 degrees of warming. Still far too much, but better than 4. But, you know, the reason I wrote this book is that we need another tool. You know, we can't get down below 2 degrees of warming, which will be a catastrophe, just by cutting emissions. We can't do it fast enough. But, you know, when I look at these new technologies, my conservative estimate is that by 2050, they can be drawing out about 40% of our annual emissions currently. So without that approach, we'll be where you say, Neil, we'll be in a very, very dark place. But we need to do two things at once. We need to cut emissions and we need to develop these technologies to scale, because we know from looking at wind and solar and other technological changes, it takes 20 to 30 years to build these things to scale where they can be drawing a gigaton of carbon out of the atmosphere. So I agree with you. We've got to be very fearful of doing nothing. But we also have to grab the opportunity of developing these new technologies and fostering a huge tech boom that's going to make wind and solar look small. But we'll need it. We'll need that to secure our future.
And I guess the question is whether when people are afraid, do they become paralyzed and feel like there is nothing I can do? Or do they feel empowered somehow and even enlightened that we have to do something to save ourselves?
I think if there is no opportunities for change, if you feel hopelessness, that leads to paralysis. But at the moment, I can see that things are going to be very dark if we do nothing. But I can also see a pathway through that that'll give us a great chance at a good future. But we've got to start now on that. We can't leave those investments for a decade and hope that they'll be ready by 2050. So as we cut emissions.
And by now you mean now. I mean,
right,
not
yeah.
like 10 years from now, but
no,
now.
Right now. I've been just talking to the Canadian government last week, the new government, just saying, if you do nothing else, you know, cut emissions, put a price on carbon, but please, please, please develop a very large innovation fund so that you can start looking at things like carbon negative concretes on a significant mm-hmm. level. A carbon nanofiber manufacture from CO2 in the atmosphere. That's so exciting. I mean, a breakthrough announced 2 months ago that we can make carbon nanofibers now at less than the cost of current production using atmospheric CO2. You know, as they get cheaper, they'll be competing directly with steel and aluminium, two major sources of emissions. So you're turning a problem into part of the solution. Such exciting technological breakthroughs, and they can't come to scale fast enough, really. I mean, we need those developments.
You're in Pennsylvania, so let me ask you about natural gas, Marcellus Shale. You know, there's a lot of natural gas in this state, and it's often been described, as you write in this book, as a bridge fuel, which is it's yeah. better than coal. It's not as good as solar or wind, but how do you suggest, and I'm thinking even the state of Pennsylvania relies on it for money and for jobs. How do you wrestle with something like that?
Well, I'm very familiar with that position because in Australia, you know, we've been dependent on coal, which is a much dirtier fuel. The market bottom's fallen out of the coal market because of competition in part with renewables and people concerned about air quality. So we're struggling with that transition at the moment. It's inevitable. We have to get off fossil fuels.
Including
natural gas. And the question I'd ask investors in the gas boom is, do you really think that natural gas is going to be burnt for electricity 30 years from now? You know, so is that, you know, because that's about how long a natural gas plant will run for, you know. Have a look at wind and solar. Look at how quickly they're developing. Look at battery technology, which is going to give wind and solar much more longevity and much more capacity to replace fossil fuels. That is developing hugely quickly. You know, look at concern over climate change. Look at the divestment movement, you know, and see if those investments look wise. And on any of those yardsticks, natural gas is a very short bridge, perhaps, to the future. You know, maybe in 3 to 5 years, maybe. You know, so you don't want to be investing your future in this sort of stuff, in my personal view.
You mentioned batteries. How do you see the role of e-vehicles or electric vehicles? And you know, there's Tesla, the more sort of high-end, but there's some other ones that are being developed as well.
Yeah, and you've really got to drive one to understand the potential of those technologies. I was in a Tesla last week in Canada. It was just amazing. You know, they make petrol-driven cars like look like old clunkers. They really do.
In terms of just how they drive and feel.
Yeah,
and
they're just so fast and they're so sophisticated. They're just a beautiful car, nice and smooth. But, you know, I hold out great hope for electric vehicles and batteries. The problem we face at the moment is a scale one. You know, Tesla, the company a little while back was valued at half the value of GM, right? You know how many cars it made last year? 36,000.
Yeah.
Right? So we're at the beginning of this thing, and it's going to take years for that to get to scale, but it can't come fast enough. I mean, China at the moment is strangling itself with its own pollution. You know, life expectancy has been cut 5.5 years in northern China just from burning fossil fuels. They want to get cars off, petrol cars off the road. But and they're pushing electric vehicles as fast as they can. But at the moment, you know, the biggest manufacturer of electric vehicles in China made 2,000 cars last year. They're going to make 20,000 this year and 200,000 probably next year. But 15 million new cars are going on the road every year in China. So you can see there's a big way to catch up.
The climate summit in around the end of November, beginning of December, you say look at India. I mean, look and see what does India do at the climate summit?
Well, I've been working with Tata Power for a decade or so, who are the biggest privately owned energy generator in India. So I see a lot of this from the outside. And India is, you know, traditionally it's seen its future a bit like China's, lots of coal-fired power plants. But that, for a number of reasons, has just not proved practical. And people in India are voting with their own wallets, even though they're slim, slender wallets at the moment. You know what the biggest or most popular dowry gift in India is now? It's solar panels with lighting. So kids can do their homework at night and women can see as they cook the evening meal, you know. So people want that stuff. And we can see now that that's the future for India. It's going to be a solar-powered future. I mean, there'll be a mix of other energy sources, hydro, nuclear maybe, but, you know, whatever. But really, in the longer term, solar is where it's going to go.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Tim Flannery. He is a scientist, an explorer, a conservationist, a writer. He's based in Australia and, again, was Australian of the Year in the year 2012. And he's got a new book. It's called Atmosphere of Hope, Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Australian climate scientist Tim Flannery about some of the things he writes about in his new book, Atmosphere of Hope, Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis. Let me get, looks like Jake from Langhorne to join us on Radio Times. Jake, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, hello.
Hi there.
Tim, a quick question on what is the positive business proposition for someone, an entrepreneur or organization, to take these great ideas on? I mean, Elon Musk did it with Tesla because he was well-financed through his PayPal. And as you even expressed, 20 to 30 years on a positive return for this type of impact. Why hasn't someone taken one of these initiatives up? I mean, does it take a Warren Buffett? Does it take a Bill Gates to do it? Because the average individual could not do these things and have a return after 15, 20 years. So how can we keep it out of the government's hand and let the capital marketplace take it and do it?
Well, Jake, thanks for the call. Let me see what Tim Flannery has to say.
Well, that's a great question, Jake. And, you know, we've seen the development pathways of things like wind and solar, and they are very long, and they do need some government inputs at the early stage, but you want to do it in a capital market, you know, free market system. But, you know, even if you're starting with a desktop study like the seaweed one, you know, going from a desktop study to some R&D is a big step. So hopefully we'll get some research and development funds to develop those sort of things. If you've got an infant industry like we have with carbon negative concretes, they need some mechanism to get them moving. One way of dealing with fostering that is to say, well, let's have a cap and trade system across the cement manufacturing industry. So just restrict it to them so that you can have you give a bit of an incentive for these carbon negative technologies to get moving. So it depends where you are in the development pathway, really. Things like biochar, the industry already exists. It's at 1,000 kilograms a year in 2013. That needs to be built just through you know, muscle, just through getting out in the marketplace and selling your product and selling its virtues. But I think this, hopefully this book will help, because we haven't had a way of thinking about these technologies before as an indispensable part of securing our future. Once you understand that, I really hope it focuses the mind of government, granting agencies, research institutions and businesses to see that, you know, we will need these technologies in 2050. The gas isn't going to get out of the air by itself. You know, the drawdown is going to have to be massive. So we need to start the development now.
Is that because things are sort of almost baked into the system, so that even if we, you know, tomorrow just stopped using fossil fuels around the world, of course it won't happen, it's still kind of baked into the atmosphere?
Well, it'll take 1,000 years to get back to pre-industrial temperature levels. And you know, we're not going to cut fossil fuels tomorrow. We're going to be emitting fossil fuels for the next couple of decades. Temperatures will, we will commit to 2 degrees of warming, and we know that is the catastrophic level. So these technologies, they have to be part of the solution. And that's why I've been pushing them so much for recognition that we need this. You know, to withdraw to reduce atmospheric concentrations of CO2 by one part per million, in the moment that we're about 400 parts per million, you've got to take 18 gigatons of CO2 out of the atmosphere.
Wow.
And that is a huge volume. It's only with a combination of these technologies we'll be able to start approaching that.
Talk a bit about carbon capture and storage. And this is something that we hear more and more.
Yeah, well, you know, when I first investigated this topic, I was really thrown down, because there was a thought a decade ago that we could use carbon capture and storage at the tailpipe of coal-fired power plants to start, you know, reducing emissions and sequestering CO2 in the ground. That just hasn't worked out, right? It's for a number of reasons it hasn't worked out. But a few researchers have gone back to basics and said, well, let's look at the Earth system itself and work out where we could store CO2 in a way that's kind of, you know, easy to do. One of the proposals that's been put forward is to store it in the Antarctic ice cap. And the argument goes like this, right? Over Antarctica, temperatures average minus 57 degrees Celsius. I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit, but it's extremely cold. They sometimes fall to minus 90 degrees Celsius. The freezing point of CO2 is minus 78.5 degrees Celsius. So once it falls below that, it rains carbon dioxide, comes down to snow, you know. So a couple of smart people said, well, what would we need to do to get temperatures down to that point over Antarctica? Turns out that you could build some big chiller boxes, like 300-foot cubes, you know, and run them from wind power, because wind power works really well in Antarctica. It's already used there.
It's always windy, isn't it?
It is, yeah. You need about half the number of wind turbines that exist in Germany now to drive enough chiller boxes to take a gigaton of CO2 out of the air as snow and bury it in the ice cap where it'd stay. It'd be stable. Right. So, you know, that is a cost-effective potential, maybe, way forward. The trouble is, when I first heard about it, I thought, my God, you know, the Antarctic, it's the last pristine continent. Do we really want to do that, you know? And I thought, I sound like one of those NIMBY people, not in my backyard people. And do I really want to deprive my children of an option that might secure their climate future that they might really need? And whatever the case of this is a desktop study. We have an obligation to do more R&D around this, so we understand the parameters, we understand the dangers or the potential benefits and the costs. And that's what I keep pushing for, that we investigate these things, so in 20 or 30 years when we're really going to need them, they should be ready.
And what does a chiller box look like? I was trying to imagine it.
It's just a big box. I don't know what you'd make it out of, to be honest with you, but you just lower the temperature. It's like a refrigerator, really, a big, you know, for chilling air. So you'd just be chilling the air, and the CO2 would fall out of snow, you know.
And then just bury that under the ice.
Yeah, just bury it under a layer of snow, your water snow, and it stays there, and that's it. It's insulated.
What about the fact that more people are moving to cities? Has that had a positive effect on emissions?
Well, it's one of the great trends we're seeing, and while we have had dirty sources of emissions and while people are using more energy when they come to cities, it's had a negative impact. But we can see now with the efficiencies that are being gained in energy use in cities, there is a huge potential to reduce emissions. I mentioned earlier that you know, renovating cities and making cities more energy efficient is a $2 trillion a year business globally. It is huge. And the push is on for everything from better insulated buildings to local generation of electricity to renewables embedded in cities to the way we use water, transport.
Urban farming,
exactly. You know, through to transport, light rail, bicycle parts, having enough density so that people can use those things efficiently. And that's changing the landscape. And I do think it's one of the great hopes of the world that we will be living in very, very energy efficient cities in 25, 30, 40 years' time.
Let me get, looks like Carson from Newtown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Carson. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm wondering to ask what possibly more could we do at home to, you know, help the emissions. I mean, I personally have a large garden myself. I feel like the effects of that could carry on, you know, large effects. I mean, you large farmers, I mean, we only have, what, 2% of the nation is farmland now. If we at home, you know, start doing more gardening, we could harvest CO2 in the form of that. We'd be eating more produce and be less reliant on the meat industry.
It's a good question, Carson, and people living around this part of Pennsylvania or this part of the world, we have really good soil on top of that and good climate for growing things. You want to weigh in on that, Tim?
Yeah, look, I think these are social trends and initiatives are hugely important. It might seem like it's just one guy talking about his garden and his produce, but there's a whole lot of people thinking this way. In my country, in Australia, we have farmers markets now where, you know, a little old Italian man down the street might grow potatoes and sell them. You know, and the great thing about those, they haven't come by truck from anywhere. They're absolutely fresh. They haven't come by truck. The carbon emissions are negligible. And it's changing the landscape for us. And I think that it's just it's such a powerful thing. Once people start living that way, it's a bit like driving an electric vehicle. Huh. You don't necessarily want to go back. You know, once you've eaten your own fresh produce and put in the effort, it becomes a new way of doing things and interacting with the world that I think is really positive. So, Carson, good on you, mate. I think it's fantastic.
Let's see what Victor from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. Victor, go ahead. You're on the air. Hi, Victor. Go ahead. You're on the air. I am going to move on and see if we can get someone else to join us on Radio Times. Can we set up Dan? Let's see what Dan from Malvern, Pennsylvania has to say. Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, a couple points, Mr. Flannery. Instead of using chiller boxes and putting a lot of energy in Antarctica, why not make farmers to get any subsidies have to increase the organic matter in the soil and burn out? It can go from the current 2 or 3% up to 5 or 6%, capture huge amounts of carbon, all done by bacteria, no energy input.
Fair enough.
Another point, Vertrolysis, a company in Massachusetts, makes biochar, but as a byproduct, they also make all kind of fuels out of it, including aviation fuel.
That's
and
very
then
cool.
And the third thing,
okay,
most important probably, is a way to get all transportation off of fossil fuels, you know, ground-based transportation, and that's using gravity field energy conversion. It's basically unknown, yet Nikola Tesla, nothing to do with the Tesla car company, demonstrated this in 1931. It's globally available, democratic, no mining, no extraction, no transmission, just an antenna and conversion equipment, and you can power anything you want, and you can have stationary stuff and replace coal and nuclear.
Well, Dan, I appreciate the call to Radio Times putting a bunch of things on the table. Tim?
Well, it's a complex bunch of things,
Dan. It is
Dan,
a complex
and,
bunch.
Look, could I begin by just saying I wholeheartedly agree with you about carbon in the soil. It's one of the approaches we're going to need. And the biochar company you mentioned, I think I mentioned them in the book, and they're a leader in that area. I guess the only point I'd make on top of that is that the problem is now so huge that we're going to need all the tools in the toolkit to save to get ourselves below that 2 degrees. I mean, building even the biochar industry from its current size up to the gigaton scale is a massive multi-decadal task. You know, getting enough carbon into the soil is the same. And those two alone, there's just not enough potential in those two to draw out the volumes we want. We've got to use other things. We'll have to be using carbon-negative concretes and probably some seaweed farming and maybe even sequestration of CO2 in Antarctica. It's hard for people to understand how big the problem is. A gigaton of CO2 is a massive, massive volume. And we're talking about drawing out, you know, 40 gigatons a year,
yeah,
just to stay still. You know, it's huge. So I think that's fair enough. In terms of the Tesla things, I'm no expert on that, and sorry, I don't know anything about that particular technology.
The gravity field.
The gravity field. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see what others make of that.
Is it also a matter of changing almost like culture? I mean, we've built our lifestyle largely on using fossil fuels without thinking about it. We have an old infrastructure that's been created so that we can do that. You have to kind of flip a switch to think differently, it seems.
You certainly do. And it's I think our imagination's a big part of that. You know, can you imagine living in a dense urban city where cycling and electric cars and things were the way to go, you know. And imagine not seeing that haze in the air, you know, that we see now from the burning of fossil fuels. Imagine our hospitals with far fewer people in them with pulmonary diseases and heart diseases, and healthier diet, you know, locally grown food being part of that, you know, lowered health costs. I think when we imagine the world, we're often limited by the capacity of our imagination, and it's good to challenge that.
It's also important to see this stuff. I mean, when you can see pollution, you look at Beijing or something like that, when you can see, you can measure sea level rise, that as opposed to the more sort of invisible ozone layer or something like that.
Well, I tell you, the American consulate in Beijing did an amazing thing for the people of China when they started releasing these particulate counts that they'd set up. Before that, and my son speaks Chinese fluently, so I'd be there and ask a taxi driver about the terrible state of the atmosphere, and he said, oh, it's just a misty day. But within 2 years of that release by the U.S. consulate, people were saying, it's terrible pollution, it's killing us, which was a fantastic
change. They could label it, right?
They could label it. They knew what it was, you know. So that is hugely important.
Let me squeeze one more caller on. Looks like we have Jan from New Jersey. And Jan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, yeah, it's Jan.
Jan, go ahead.
I had a question. It seems that that's a question nobody addresses, and that's population growth. I mean, even if you were to reduce everybody's carbon footprint by 50%, as the world's population continues to grow, that would offset any kind of savings you would have. And how do you see that working into the problem?
Jan, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
You know, look, the demographic trajectory is not entirely set, but it's pretty much set. I mean, it looks like there's going to be about 9 billion or maybe 10 billion people on the planet by 2050. There's currently 7 billion. We could lower that number if we were willing to better the condition of women in the developing world, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa.
They have fewer kids, right?
Yeah, exactly, because you give them a better economic status, you give them more autonomy. That's what people do. They limit their kids. But that's only part of the reason for the growth, the demographic growth. The other reason is people are just living longer globally, so that's adding to the population effectively. So we're going to have to deal with a world of between 8 and, say, 10 billion by 2050. I am confident that we can do that, that the efficiency gains that we can make in terms of our energy use and our food production and so forth will allow us to sustain that. It'll be a strained situation, but I think it'll allow us to do that. Hopefully in coming centuries, then population will slowly decline back to a more sustainable level. But you're right, Jan, that population is something we don't talk about very much, and it is one of the factors we need to take into account.
And what makes you an optimist?
Well, for 8 years, you know, after I wrote The Weathermakers and went through the Copenhagen meeting, I was really struggling to be an optimist. But what's changed for me now is that we can see that we're making a difference. It's huge. All those little things have added up to something huge. People recognise the problem now. They know we have to act. And the opportunity for young people in these third wave technologies, I mean, the tech boom that's going to come with that will make the things we've seen so far look small. And I know young people, they're ambitious. They want to change the world. They want to get involved. And I think they will. And they will change the world. So for all of those reasons, and my imagination of 2050 is such that I think I really do genuinely think that we've got a great future.
Well, Tim Flannery, it's been a great pleasure. You've inspired us all. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And again, the book is called Atmosphere of Hope, Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis. And he is an Australian-based scientist, explorer, and conservationist. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out how to download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Diana Allen, our intern this fall for Radio Times, and our engineer is Kevin Griffin. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.